Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 89, section 2, which is old single column, page 975. So we got into this new paper. Remember, it's entitled Sin, Sacrifice, and Atonement. So it's obviously building up to that sort of culmination of themes that is atonement. Of all of the, as I was saying last week, what you might call technical terms of theology that they start throwing out in this paper left and right. That one looms largest for many people of the last, 100, 150 years as problematic, and causes many to stumble, or at least begin to stumble upon the details of the theologic context that they find themselves in the midst of, in whatever religion obviously, most specifically, whatever sect of Christianity you may find yourself initially, born into or identifying with or whatever. But it's not a concept that just fell out of nowhere, right at the very beginning. It's the culmination of a very long process of things building up, as we've been, going through all the preceding papers, getting a number of the kind of larger contextual elements in place, and now they're focusing in directly on that line within that context that gets you to atonement. And the key foundational element, if you will, is there again in the title of the paper. It's all kind of predicated on some direct conception of what you're going to call sin. And it's the concept of sin that we're going to develop here next that that gives the appropriate complexity, sophistication, you might say, that leads to such full fruits of all of this ghost cult fetish, spirit land sort of stuff that gives you current religion, religion's theological notions. You have to get sin in place before you can really figure out what that's all about. But as we saw last time, the definition that people settled on for this key concept of sin requires a pre-existent concept. It's defined relative to taboo. As we'll see here shortly, sin is defined as transgression of taboo. And so you can't talk about sin until you first talk about taboo. They gave us that intro where we're reminded of that in a moray system, which you have going way, way, way back, you have something that you could effectively call a moray system. There's always going to be the thou shalt not elements of that moray system. Those are the taboos. Any moray system begins with elements that are the folk ways. In general, you can tell from the sound of folk ways, that's just kind of the way that those folks do things, right? And so it isn't necessarily all about negativity. Thou shalt not. It's just, you know, this is a way you celebrate this. This is the way you commemorate that. This is the way you hunt this. This is the way you build that, you know, whatnot. A mores system always has naturally positive elements. But as soon as people start getting those religious juices, you know, what you can call religious juices flowing, people start to get very serious, very existential, very absolutist, solemn, right? And you get that rudimentary spiritual consciousness spun up, and it always begins in that negative mode, fault finding mode. I usually say an error and evil detector, right, is how it starts out. So, you know, you see, obviously when it goes from, you know, what you could say is just society to something that's more appropriately called religion, you're definitely going to get these taboo elements, these innately sharp negative elements in the mores system. And just saying that again, remember that we talked about that, how important that is, that it starts out non-religious, you know, one could say. It starts out secular. And then notions of sacredness come in. And remember, we were talking about how we are seeing that cycle repeating here over the last 100, 150 years as things finally came to a head with the old mores system, and you know, especially the taboos that were so keyed upon relative to sin with ecclesiastical authority, and the secular revolt was rejecting that, you know, that basic old mores frame. And for a little while, we sort of just hadn't. We tried to not have any more frame. We tried to just erase all of that because we just rejected all that as wholly false. But of course that's forgetting that mores system is natural. I mean, you can't keep it away. It will reform. You're not going to be able to maintain enough focus for it to not start reforming again. And so, as we saw, you know, especially towards the latter part of the 20th century, you know, we went from, you know, an attempt to have no mores system very overtly to, sure enough, we started to get a mores system, in place, and people were starting to talk about how this is correct and that's not, you know, and when you don't have religion, you need something you can apply your zeal to. Politics is usually it, right? And so this correctness, instead of being religious correctness, is political correctness. Yeah, and so we got this secular correctness, in other words, righteousness, you know, the beginnings of that going again. And sure enough, after, you know, just a few decades of that, it starts to get that religiosity built into it, and people start wanting to use the word moral again. They want to, you know, not just say it's correct, they want to say it's right. Now, of course, this is all, you know, just as false in an objective sense use of the word morality as it was 200 years ago or 10,000 years ago, okay? But, you know, we want to use that word. That word is in our heads. And so we start to religiousize our political correctness, and it starts to become a moral issue. And that means that we're on the verge of getting full-on taboos in place again in a new mode. And there will be a new consciousness of, you know, consciousness, quote-unquote, of sin relative to those new taboos. The cycle is just, you're seeing it repeat right before our eyes. And it doesn't take as long now to kind of reset all this as it would have, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, because we're just so much more spiritually animated now as individuals than we were way back when. And if nothing else, you know, Michael did in the wake of his activities here 2,000 years ago tends to juice things up. And certainly in the 20th century, we can see that the evolution of mind engagement has been juicing us up even more. And so, yeah, so it's all accelerated. And so in the span of a lifetime, you can watch it go from nothing all the way back to a whole newfound sin sacrifice and atonement. And it's like, wow. So, once we really get sin in place, we'll get sacrifice. Yeah, we'll get sacrifice in place again. And right, so it'll all get very aggressive again.
There's already confession.
right. You definitely have to confess your sins already. I mean, you're seeing this more and more. All right. All of these technical terms, you know, of historical theology will all get reapplied. But they'll be basically the same scheme. All right, so this is a very important thing to, you know, the very fact that you could easily, because it's so dynamic in the age in which you're living, get caught up again in that, it's all the more important that the revelators eventually not only lay out what the old-fashioned definition of sin is, so you can see what's going on for what it is, but you can very, very definitively not get caught up in that, step out of that, and find the true definition of sin for the first time revealed to mankind, right, in the fifth epical revelation. It's not that sin is just a bunch of baloney, as it appeared coming out of the Enlightenment. There is something that's appropriately called sin. It doesn't matter how ignorant humans have been of what that word is supposed to be applied to. But before you can get to all things becoming new, you have to clearly understand what it's always been, so you know what the old wineskin is, so you're not going to try to use the new definition in the old wineskin. All right. let's see what we have here about this ominous word sin.
Section 2, the concept of sin. The fear of chance and the dread of bad luck literally drove man into the invention of primitive religion as supposed insurance against these calamities. For magic and ghosts, religion evolved through spirits and fetishes to taboos. Every primitive tribe had its tree of forbidden fruit, literally the apple, but figuratively consisting of 1,000 branches, hanging heavy with all sorts of taboos. And the forbidden tree always said, "Thou shalt not."
Okay. You know, and it's, you know, like we were saying recently, it's important to say "thou," right? Because it's that ominous, right? It's not just you shall not, it's thou shalt not, right? It's, you know, it's important to actually keep that old language in, because it reminds you of you know, like I was saying, just how, you know, sobered you are, you know, and how serious you take this. Yeah, very solemn stuff, yes. Okay, just note little things when they start out. The fear of chance, the dread of bad luck. You know, remember that contrast? You know, think about the contrast between mere fear and dread. You know, that you take the fear on the zeroth level of meaning, and you lift it up and you spiritualize it on the first level of meaning as dread.
And breeds anxiety.
Right, and of course, yeah, I mean, it breeds anxiety and all sort of stuff much more effectively, because you're existentializing things a little bit. And just think about how they've paired it. See, you know, that very in the moment of sense of the word chance compared to the more conceptual thing of luck, right? Looming in the future is a blob of bad luck, you know, and you're dreading the future because of that ominous black cloud on the horizon. I see you're existentializing, you're taking it out of the moment a little bit. and getting dread. Notice not only chance and luck, but they're reminding you, like I said, of all these elements that we've been building up, magic and ghosts, and then religion evolved through spirits and fetishes to taboos. So we have kind of all of the context in place, like I was saying, to talk about sin now, the concept of sin. And, think about, as they're bringing up the classic story in Genesis about Adam and Eve and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, contrast to the tree of life, right? But here we're talking about the tree of so-called tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which wasn't there literally historically, and they're kind of reminding you of that. I mean, the big thing is the figuratively, right, about the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Just pause for a second. As they get you to think about all of this ominous "thou shalt not" of the taboo. And the name. Wait a minute. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Why is that so ominous? Right? Why is knowledge so ominous? Remember, in the section at the end of the preceding paper. Remember when they mentioned that indeed in the days of barbarism it was dangerous to know very much? Right? There was always the chance of being executed as a black artist. It goes way, way back to things like that. And that's carried forward. You continue that forward, as I've mentioned many times, all the way to the present day. Many religiously inclined people, including readers of the Urantia book, still have that tendency to exalt ignorance. See, that harkens all the way back to that. It's best not to know very much, what you're supposed to do is cultivate a sacred ignorance. And in that sacred ignorance, you find the unfathomable mystery of God. This is a rationalization scheme that you may not even recognize that you've bought into, but you have to some degree, because you've been bathing in it since you were born. It's why if you call God the unknowable, you can't help but say, ooh, I think I like that concept of God as the unknowable, right? It's because of that falsely exalted ignorance mentality. And so the tree of the knowledge, see? Knowledge, that's a dangerous thing. It's best not to have knowledge. Now, of course, a little more precisely, when you go from knowledge to knowledge of good and evil, it's like, wait a minute, how do I know the difference between good and evil? That's in the upper domain. That's relative to my encirclement in the Holy Spirit. Well, what am I doing if I'm consciously pushing myself away from my discriminators that could distinguish between good and evil? I'm dehumanizing myself in the name of, trying to do what God expects of me or something. Yeah, it's very problematic if you think about it precisely.
You don't want to ask too many questions.
Right? All those people, it's best not to ask too many questions. There's certain questions you just shouldn't ask. What have you? There's many different variations, but you can recognize. Like I was pointing out, it all goes back to some of those really primitive fears, like about not getting executed for being a sorcerer, because, you figured out how to increase the yield of your crop. I discovered, if I water it, it grows more, and you get executed for being a sorcerer. Right. I mean, it was literally that hopeless, remember, as they pointed out.
I thought if I steal it from my neighbor.
Right. So,
Water his too that way.
Yeah, everyone got this sort of.
You better water his too.
fear embedded in their genetics and passed it on to their, you know, their children practically. You know, it's just a very deep-rooted fear that has morphed into what we think of as our appropriate, sophisticated notions, you know, relative, you know, to being humble. I mean, wouldn't that be prideful to think I could know something of God? Okay, but you're overplaying it. It's like, don't you think that there's some concept that you're supposed to be able to have a relationship with God? Didn't at least Jesus say that you should seek for a relationship to God? If God is unknowable, okay, you know, what was Jesus telling you to do? It doesn't make any sense.
Something that was here before then hardly known. Yeah. Because the Jews, their relationship to God was through their group.
Yeah, right.
No individual relationship; it was all through.
Yeah.
Their nation.
Yeah, not only was it a very much of a group relationship to God, it was barely a relationship to God until the exile. It was, you know, just social justice, and so, you know, that's why it starts so innately a group thing. It's social, right? Not individual justice, social justice, right? So it starts in this collective mode, and Jesus was trying to get them to initiate a genuine religious nature, which is only there as an individual. There is no such thing as a collective religious fact. It's purely individual. To be precise, it's absolutely unique to you. It's personal. Spiritual experience. Right? It was very difficult for him, and it's still difficult for us to get out of those collective modalities of rationalizing things. So, anyway, you've got that whole biblical concept of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. As you can tell from what they're saying there, I mean, everyone figuratively had such a tree. And as we kind of pointed out, until prophets or revelatory efforts helped to prune some of the branches off of that tree, it had lots and lots of branches, all of them heavy laden. I mean, everyone's lives, you know, every second of every day of every, you know, moment of their life, was just filled with this taboo and that taboo. I mean, it was just complete oppression under the weight of all these taboos. Remember how we talked about Moses helping to pare things down to 10 commandments and stuff like that, right? I mean,
and then the Jews brought it back up to 600.
Right, you know, and then you get the Pharisees going, and, you know, and you've got books and books and books and books filled of, you know, with stuff again, right?
And Jesus pared it down to two.
Right. Yeah. These, like I said, these revelatory sort of indirect revelatory prophet efforts, you know, have been trying to keep it pared down. But the natural tendency is just to go to infinite complexity, okay? Like the tax code. Okay? All right, so what else do they say here?
As the savage mind evolved to that point where it envisaged both good and bad spirits, and when the taboo received the solemn sanction of evolving religion, the stage was all set for the appearance of the new conception of sin. The idea of sin was universally established in the world before revealed religion ever made its entry. It was only by the concept of sin that natural death became logical to the primitive mind. Sin was the transgression of taboo, and death was the penalty of sin.
Okay, so you can see how we're, like I said, we're bringing a number of things that they brought up way back, you know, to fruition here. You know, that mysterious natural death thing, remember we talked about quite a ways back, and humans trying to rationalize that. Then you know, start at the beginning of the paragraph. Okay, yeah, you know, the one thing I hadn't mentioned, we've got the whole dual spiritism, right? So we bring that in, and like I said, see, obviously the taboo starts out as what we would call secular. today, and then evolves into sacred. Right? It received the solemn sanction of evolving religion. Okay, and so then you have this new conception, which is called S-I-N. You see sin italicized there. You got this, you're going to define that, this concept. And notice, you know, them pointing out that it, how completely natural this is, and how kind of foundational and inescapable this is, that you go, you can go back pre-planetary prints where you literally have only primitive man. Remember the definition, you know, in the simplest sense of primitive man is pre-planetary prince man on any world. And so, you know, we often talk about primitive, okay, but, you know, this is like just, you know, by mere definition, we're talking primitive. And yet, you get this very fancy concept. So reminding you, even in the most primitive of humans, you're still encircled in the Holy Spirit. You still have very, very fancy mind that's trying to find something to play with, right? It's why, as I was just saying a second ago, it's why everything gets more and more complicated. I mean, yeah, I mean, in general, no one is extremely simple-minded, right? Just to be human is really to not be simple-minded. You know, a human is just complicated of mind. And so everything that humans focus on for any length of time just tries to, you know, be given enough handles and knobs for all the different phases of mind to play with. Yeah. So you've got this in a completely primitive context, pre-revelation, developing, and as they're saying, you know, finally, when someone dies a natural death, you have a definitive way to rationalize it. It's that, you know, prior efforts were sort of like quasi-satisfying, and now everyone is really fully satisfied. They feel like they've finally solved the mystery. It's transgression of taboo that's behind this. You know, the wages of sin is death. Right? Now, as you have Paul saying it in Romans, right? Or you can even, you know, remind yourself of what they brought up in the first paragraph, right? If you go back to the story in Genesis about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, right? What was the notion there? You know, you're not supposed to eat, you know, from this tree, but if you do, you will surely die, right? Because, right, it would be transgression of a taboo, that the wages of sin is death. Okay. But, you know, it's like that, in a way, see, you know, you think this was like terribly oppressive thought to adopt, but actually it was delightfully liberating. I mean, finally you could let go of really your fear of this. You understood what was going on. I mean, when you didn't have some rationalization scheme where you quote-unquote understand it, that's what was really scary about it. Oh, well, it's just like original sin. Okay, it's very straightforward. It's less of a boogeyman. See, and as soon as you start to get rid of those quote-unquote understandings, death is going to get scarier again. All right? And so, like they pointed out, that was such a key element, the mystery of natural death. If you have so-called modern man sweeping away all the old rationalization schemes because he decides they're silly, he's going to reawaken his full animal fear, no longer tempered by an understanding, right? No matter how silly it might be objectively. it was an understanding, and it calmed you down. You know, it soothed the savage beast within you. And so, don't be surprised if, you know, current people are getting more and more worked up about, you know, death and trying to avoid it. And, you know, they'll come up with, you know, instead of coming up with a scheme where you need a shaman to do a certain thing, you know, with spirit land, right, you got a technological solution to it now, right? But, of course, that shaman spirit land, that was the technology of that day. You know, like we pointed out, that's got science started, remember? Right? So, you know, it's just now we think, yeah, but it's not imaginary technology. This is real technology. Yeah, right. Yeah. Like freezing your head in a cryo bin is a real technology. Yeah, right. You'd be better off with the shaman. Okay? But anyway.
And you know what the nice thing about the adventure book is? Mm-hmm. Is that when you really realize what life after death is all about, I can see in the future that people might be more excited about dying than living in some cases. I know what Don
Sure.
Green was.
Yeah. Right. See, again, you know, if you actually know about what lies after death, you know, in a way you really don't care about understanding death anymore. It's like, whatever. I don't need to understand it, right? I mean, you know, any more than I need to understand why the moment 3 seconds ago was significant in the grand universe, or why the one just right now. You know, I mean, I don't need to understand why every moment is somehow significant, meaningful, or what. I can just let it be what it is. And I can just keep my eyes set on a glorious future that the existence of which is not dependent upon me understanding the why of every moment between here and my destiny.
Yeah. That's what's so nice about what they say. It's not so important what you are, it's what you're becoming.
Yeah, and again, all those sorts of things, you know. You know, put eternity first, then start to deal with time, right?
Don't be so heavenly minded that you're no earthly.
I didn't say put heavenly only, you know, eternity only, right? You know, so that you're so heavenly minded your earthly are good, right? I mean, you know, any more than Jesus said, seek only the kingdom of heaven, right? He just said, seek first, right? Right? And that means there's a second, and a third, and a fourth, right? There must be a second, third, and fourth, or there wouldn't be a first. First implies there's subsequent, right?
So, when we're looking forward to the future so strongly, you know, we still need to aspire to feast and feast on uncertainty and on.
Well, I mean, see, technically, you're not going to look to the future. You know there's a future. Remember, eternity is not temporal, it's existential, right? Right? So it's not about, you know, looking to that future time. It's just knowing that your existence is immutable. You are, right? I mean,
value so, now and then.
Yeah, I mean, see, again, because the eternity that we're talking about is existential eternity, not experiential eternity. It's not something in the future. It's something that exists right now. If you would just awaken to the recognition of it, right? And like I've said many times, it's like, well, how do I know it exists right now? Because just pause and reflect for a moment. If it didn't exist right now, you wouldn't exist. Your existence, you know, proves there's an existential, that there's an eternal. Right? You are. Right? That first fundamental verb, right, is the adoption of the recognition of the eternal. Right? You know, it's not some temporal verb like jumping or singing or, right? No, it's just is. Right? Being. I mean, that you know, that verb is in the dictionary, and it's deeply mysterious if you think about it. Because by grace we're humans. You know, as you've heard me say probably, I mean, think about it. Do you remember back when you were a kid, your parents sitting down and trying to explain the verb to be to you? You might remember them trying to explain, you know, some action verb. Like, you know, well, when you do that, that's called jumping, you know. Or, you know, and in contrast to, well, and you do it like that, that's called hopping. You know, or like that, it's called skipping. Or, right, you may remember them trying to sort some of those details out. But did they? But did they sit down and explain to you what the verb to be is about? No, somehow that just is in the foundation of your mind. It just comes to be known within you, right? Right. That's because you are, and you're not only do you exist, but you're given self-awareness so that you can know that you exist. Right? And it's just there. It's the most trivially immediate foundational self-evident fact about you.
So my pooch exists but doesn't know
it exists. Right, but doesn't know it exists. Right. An animal is not self-aware. You know, in the full sense that, you know, I mean by, you know, when I say, I mean objectively self-aware, not just some subjective level, okay? You're objectively self-aware, right? So that, in other words, it goes all the way up to where you can know that you exist. And until you get to an objective level, you can't know that. Right? Because all the subjective is going to be inescapably temporal things. Okay, so anyway, we got way off on that, but philosophic elements are important. So we're in the proper frame to think about what they're telling us here. So anyway, you know, back, you know, we've got this definitive notion of taboos. And with all of their solemn grandeur, okay, and then your relationship to that is this: what this word "sin" is about. If you transgress a taboo, that's sin. So, you know, the fact that the proper definition of sin has nothing to do with taboos or transgressions. You know, see, it's a huge step. You're not going to figure that out easily. Everything in you is going to fight against you getting out of that frame. Yeah. See, and like they were saying, you know, when you start to think like this, you know, as they said there early on, you know, this drove man into the invention of primitive religion as supposed insurance against these calamities. And I mean, this, you know, these two paragraphs together here, you know, they're trying to remind you, like I've been doing throughout all these papers, of what you think when you hear the word religion, and how what the revelators want you to think when they say religion has nothing whatsoever to do with any of that. It's so extremely different what they're talking about, right? You know, because everything that humans have always talked about is temporal. Calamities are temporal, right? You know, and if you try to explain to someone that religion has nothing to, real religion doesn't have anything to do with you know, your temporal issues, you know, God helping you to avoid or to work through calamities, or, you know, even if Jesus says, you know, I'll help you walk through your calamities, okay, but that's not what religion is about. if you make what Jesus said their religion, that's Jesusism. That's not religion. That's an ideology about Jesus, you know, holding your hand as you walk through calamities. That's not religion. See, religion is about eternity, not about time. So it's very difficult to, you know, to get out of this mode, like they're saying, because everything is predicated on temporal affairs.
You don't hear that much these days, you know, what you said.
Yeah.
That's about eternity, not about time.
It's not about time. Right? I mean, it's just one of the most problematic things about a creator son coming to a world in the first place. You know, and making it appear all the more that, you know, this is, you know, he's literally God, okay? So it just makes it all the more obvious, quote unquote, supposedly, right? That's what God is all about, is temporal issues. See, it makes it all the more difficult. See, on the one hand, he can try to encourage you, right, to go back to eternity and actually establish genuine religion, but his very presence is countering that. That's why, you know, the longer he stayed, the worse it got, and finally he knew he had to get out of here pretty darn quick, because he was getting people so focused on time, you know, he was becoming a net negative to this, helping him get related to eternity. He made time so interesting. Who cares about eternity? Right? When you got this fancy a temporal thing right in front of you, and a material thing at that, right, just to make it all the worse, right? It just is becoming hopeless, right, for him to get anyone to have any interest, you know, in that which has nothing to do with what's going on in front of their eyes. Okay, but back to sin, right? It's going to be a temporal thing. You've got these taboos in time, and your transgression of them in time is sin, supposedly. All right, what else do they say?
Sin was ritual, not rational. An act, not a thought. And this entire concept of sin was fostered by the lingering traditions of Dilmun in the days of a little paradise on earth. The tradition of Adam in the Garden of Eden also lent substance to the dream of a one-time golden age of the dawn of the races. And all this confirmed the ideas later expressed in the belief that man had his origin in a special creation, that he started his career in perfection, and that transgression of the taboos, sin, brought him down to his later sorry plight.
Okay, yeah, so not only sin, but obviously original sin, you know, getting going there. And that the key thing to really leverage it from just mere sin explaining natural death to original sin explaining our sorry plight, a supposed sorry plight, you've got this, again, you've got revelators coming in, you know, came and, yeah. We barely got anything positive from them, but we latched on to a whole bunch of negative things. It got us to dream this false dream of we all began in a golden age. We all began in perfection, and then there was a fall, right? And, you know, and they're all thinking, oh, Lordy, no, that's exactly what I didn't want you to think about because I came. Just like Jesus would, you know, say, you know, Nathaniel, Nathaniel, how long must I bear with you or something. It's like, no, that's exactly the opposite of what I was hoping you'd get from my presence here. But nonetheless, between the, you know, remember, you know, how what the deal is with Dilmun, you know, you have Dalmatia, but, you know, you've got the rebellion and eventually the master physical controllers erase that. They move to the northeast a little bit, you know, there in Mesopotamia and found Dilmun. You know, so for the, you know, for the evolving mythology of the Nadites going forward, say those 50,000 years until the Tower of Babel, By then they're looking back to their quote unquote first garden, if you will, is Dillman, okay, most kind of directly. Just like so much of the Adam and Eve garden is the second garden and not the first garden in terms of the stories we have, right? But you get that false concept notice how here we're losing our natural recognition that we evolved from animals. We're setting up, a long dark time of magical origin for mankind. We have to rediscover evolution in the 19th century because Adam and Eve are here, and we have dim memories of it that got us off on that false track of what you might call creationism, sort of, and a special creation at that. God just made fancy people, and then they fell. He made beautiful people, and they became ugly, or whatever. Now, of course, the interesting thing about that, think about, just a little aside. Our local universe God, Creator Son, made the original material son and daughter, right? The innately, indelible, eternal pair, and all subsequent material sons and daughters, and then Adam and Eve's and children are all downsteps from that original pair. They all have fallen down from the original pair, if you will. See, there's a thread of truth there. That we unwittingly are playing into. But anyway, as we're stressing again, sin is transgression of taboo. And so that's our core concept. Once you start in kind of the secular mode and then religiousize it and get taboos and sin, you'll see they're going to point out next. Obviously, we know as we continue forward, eventually humans start to separate society from religion again, separate state from church, right? And so you're going to rediscover a more secular mode related to taboos. How does that work? So let's see what they say here.
The habitual violation of a taboo became a vice. Primitive law made vice a crime. Religion made it a sin. Among the early tribes, the violation of a taboo was a combined crime and sin. Community calamity was always regarded as punishment for tribal sin.
I skipped. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're fine. I skipped. I glanced down at the wrong line. Okay.
To those who believed that prosperity and righteousness went together, the apparent prosperity of the wicked occasioned so much worry that it was necessary to invent hells for the punishment of taboo violators. The numbers of these places of future punishment have varied from 1 to 5.
Okay. Yep. Sorry about that. I glanced down looking for the word sin at the end of the sentence. And so those two sentences both end in the word sin, so I skipped a sentence. Okay. Well, that's a good thing, because we're about to talk about that forgiveness thing. I'm glad that's in play. as long as I do the proper penance, right? Let's see. So like I was saying, there it is. So you have the habitual violation of taboo. That's the sense of that kind of curious word, vice. And like I was saying, eventually, we all know that we have, part of of police departments that are involved with vice, right? And see, you know, it's like, well, what's the deal with that? You know, okay, see, that's as you separated state from church, right? You still have the heaviness of vice, right? And so, certain crimes are not just going to be crimes; they're going to be vice crimes, right? And of course, as we all know, so much taboo focus, as they'll talk about here shortly, is related to sex. Okay. Or if it's not sex, it's going to be, you know, because all of the religious notions that, like, we've been reading that are tied to sex. But the very fact that we call them spirits, right, that's a religious thing, see? And you're not going to call it sin anymore, but you're going to still call it vice, right, if it involves. See, so it's the things that involve, you know, basically playing around with, inappropriately with spirit land, okay, in some way or another. Religion made it a sin. But see, like they said, I mean, among the early tribes, the violation of a taboo was a combined crime and sin because you hadn't separated state from church. And so, it was all just together. And like I said, the common underlying theme, like they pointed out, is vice. You know, you just have vice in two domains, you call it sin in the religious domain. And just call it vice in the criminal domain. Notice here again. In the same way that you have this extension of sin, the concept of sin from just an individual issue. So, like, it's relating to natural death of an individual. You generalized it, if you will, to that original sin, you know, so that you take it all the way back to the beginning of time, and hence make it kind of for all time. You know, you generalize it in that way. The other way is just at a given time, generalize it to all the people in a group. Right, so these different ways of generalizing sin from an individual issue to a group issue. So you have, like, tribal sin, you know. So if the neighboring hordes burn your village down, you know, the two people that survive know what the issue was. Obviously, you know, it was a sinful village, and the wages of sin is death. They deserve to be burned to the ground. And then, of course, like the Jewish people, definitely tied prosperity and righteousness, they're an example of that. That immediately sets up, see, when you start with that false assumption that prosperity and righteousness are tied together, you know, you're inescapably going to have a subsequent additional false assumption to make up for that first one, so that, quote unquote, two wrongs make a right, if you will, right? Two false assumptions can cancel each other out, and it can still synchronize with observation. Okay? So just like if you assume the nucleus of the atom is made out of protons and neutrons, you have to assume the existence of the strong force to hold them together, right? If you assume that prosperity and righteousness are tied together, then you have to assume there's a hell, or hells, so that the wages of sin is still death, right? In some way, you know, and that it doesn't seem like it's apparent. Well, this totally quote unquote wicked person, this taboo violator, right, went through their whole life without any consequence. The fact that they still died of a natural death just wasn't adequate. See, in other words, you've begun to move away from that. See, as soon as you start generalizing sin away from that individual thing, it's not going to be enough that so-called wicked person dies a natural death. Right? You know, he needs to pay, right? Yeah, for his crimes slash sins, right? Because they, you know, they're one and the same. So there has to be hells, and you know, and just the very fact that you'd have, you know, from one to five, or even if you have just one hell, the more you think about that, the more you'll have many levels in that one hell. Yeah, yeah, whether it be Dante or whatever, right? Yeah, because again, that natural tendency to complexify it, right? And you know, and you know, this person doesn't need to go to hell. This person needs to go to a level of hell or a special hell designed just for his specific taboo violations, so that it can be focused more exquisitely, you know, relative to his wickedness. Right.
There's still a special place in hell.
Yeah, right. And, right. Yeah, quote unquote. There's a special place in hell. Right. Yeah. So that, you know, all of that, and you know, think about, you know, like I said, if you have issues in letting go of standard theologic construct, you shouldn't be reading what we're reading right now. Because, you know, it is just ruthlessly tearing into all this. What do you mean, invent hells? Yeah. You know, that's blasphemy. Yeah. I mean, you know, I should be you know, executed and sent to hell just for saying that someone invented hell. You know, try to convince, you know, a serious Christian that there isn't hell. Right.
He'll put you through hell for that.
I mean, if there isn't hell, nothing makes sense to them. You know, and they're correct. See, like they're saying, I mean, that's the only way to understand life. If you take away hell, it doesn't make sense. You know, and it doesn't occur to them that they have to erase everything. You know, that you aren't actually saying that there isn't a hell. You're saying that none of their thoughts are valid. Yeah. None. Their entire scheme is illusory. Okay?
I was going to say that I know Christians who don't believe in hell. But maybe they're not serious.
Yeah, Christians. See, that's why I said that. See, right. You know, they're not just, you know, it's one thing to be a cultural Christian. You know, and of course, it's easier and easier to be just a cultural Christian, like a cultural Jew, when to be a Christian is just about social justice. Right? It's not serious anymore, right? I mean, see, again, and even if their religious notions were, you know, have always been false, at least they were serious, right? You know, and they're about to emphasize that as we go forward into the next section. I mean, humans need something to get them serious about things. So they're not just totally flippant, anything goes, you know, self-control, smelf-control, you know? No, something's got to focus you, you know, put the fear of God into you. Otherwise, you have anarchy. Okay? Because no one has the law written in their hearts. Right? So you have to be ruled by fear in order for there not to be just complete anarchy. Unfortunately, that's the way primitive humans, you know, have some order in their society. All right, so let's see, anything else there? Obviously, you notice how the, you know, future punishment, you know, the other thing that's kind of feeding up to the next section, you know, as soon as you've got sin and, you know, you initially have just this simplicity of, You know, there's sin, and then and death is the consequence. It's very simple. Okay. But it gets more and more complicated. You know, there's more and more shades of gray that get fed in. And so, you know, there's, you know, punishment in a whole hierarchy, you know, the greatest of which is death, you know, and punishments on a whole spectrum lesser than that, you know, and all that begins to develop.
The idea of confession and forgiveness early appeared in primitive religion. Men would ask forgiveness at a public meeting for sins they intended to commit the following week. Confession was merely a rite of remission, also a public notification of defilement, a ritual of crying, "Unclean, unclean." Then followed all the ritualistic schemes of purification. All ancient peoples practiced these meaningless ceremonies. Many apparently hygienic customs of the early tribes were largely ceremonial.
Okay, so let me start with that next last sentence. All ancient peoples practiced these meaningless ceremonies. Like I said, I mean, to let that sink in. Like I said, you know, what they're saying is every notion that every religionist has in their head, it's all meaningless. It doesn't matter how serious they are about it, how solemnly, right, they go through these rituals. I mean, this is not something you tell the timid soul. You shouldn't be anyway, right? This is ruthless what they're doing here. Because I mean, there's nothing left. I mean, once they're done here. I mean, it's like, well, no, they you still have God. No, you know they don't really have God. They've got a ghost cult notion of God. I mean, see, what the revelators are trying to say is you've got nothing right now, you know, in terms of what you inherit from the evolutionary predecessors. It's just nothing there. There's no value, hence there's no meaning, right? It's all just things and illusions. There's no real value, and hence no real meaning. It's not really related to spirit at all. Material things and illusions. And God is just the greatest illusion, you know, in the whole construct. Okay, it's not the real God. So, this is, you know, this is not for those people who, like, for instance, only have any self-control because of this whole scheme. Only don't go catatonic because of this whole scheme. Only don't commit suicide because of this whole scheme. Well, you know, whatever. It's not for those people. Right? It's for a select few that are ready to just let go of the whole scheme and voyage out into a domain of complete mystery to find reality for the first time. Let's see here. Anything else we have there? Oh, okay. Now just the details. See, I told you we've got this complexity building of confession and forgiveness. Yeah, obviously, you know, there isn't a lot of place for the notion of forgiveness if it's somehow that full singular mode of the wages of sin is death, period. you had to have kind of graded out some, right, for you to really find a place for forgiveness. But of course, again, the whole notion of forgiveness is based upon a false assumption, as if God takes any offense. That's not the real God. The real God takes no offense. And there really is no such notion as forgiveness. Right, so all the schemes about forgiveness, that's all meaningless. It doesn't relate to anything real. And see, that's pretty extreme stuff. And, you know, but the only way that you could force people to adopt some humility is to believe that God was offended and they need to seek forgiveness. Right? They need, you know, like they're saying there, you need remission of your sins. Yeah. Forgiveness of your sins. And just notice that, I mean, you know, like I said, you keep getting these kind of technical terms in the theology, like remission and confession, forgiveness, whatnot. Notice how many of them have an R-E prefix, which is kind of interesting. You see, there's kind of a vague notion that there is some sort of going back thing, the re of religion. You know, and so there's various sort of temporal re's, you know, that you've got, see, where you're trying to go back, thinking that religion is about this, you know, like remission, you know, you've sent something forth, now you got to send it back. Okay. See how we're trying to find a place for, we know that somehow there's a back, you know, but we don't appreciate back to eternity. It all has to be rationalized temporally. So it's a temporal forward and back, like propitiate, right? You know, and there you got the forward thing, the pro, and then you got these re's, these backs. It's all being rationalized like this. You know, and just and notice how they're finding a way to bring in, you know, what we would call material pragmatism. So that isn't just spiritual idealism. Men would ask forgiveness at a public meeting for sins they intended to commit the following week. Okay, I mean they're, you know, they're looking ahead. They know the only way to prevent the village from being destroyed is they're going to have to take proactive, make a proactive effort here. But then go, yeah, but crap, that's a violation of taboo to do that. So that's going to be a sin. Yeah, but it's got to be done. Practically, it has to be done. You know, so you complexify your so-called spiritual idealism, right? Your, you know, your religious scheme to allow for that. It's a budding way of beginning to find a way to bring material pragmatism and spiritual idealism together. Right? It's all silliness, right? A rationalization scheme, but nonetheless, you're trying to face facts and adjust them to ideals. See, the fact is, we got to do something, and the fact that it's called a taboo. Well, okay, it doesn't change the fact that we've got to do something. Right, so, it's not the ideal thing to do because it's a violation of a taboo, right? And so there, it's an evolutionary process. They're trying to start to, or they're beginning to try to bat things back and forth like that. Let's see. And then, you know, like they mentioned, you have that whole purity thing, clean, unclean. How significant that is. You know that so when you develop this sin concept. Like I said, it sort of gives, it seems to give this full rock solid understanding of what you've always meant by clean and unclean and all those vague fuzzy notions that you started with, you know, that all start back with, you know, your vague continuumness, unity sense, you know, that feels like purity, right? Or cleanliness, right? So you think you finally have figured out the physics of all this, you know, how to really not have such vague, fuzzy, hand wavy definitions for what unclean means, for instance. And it seems to be definitive now. You know, and that reminds me, one of the things we didn't talk about back there. Yeah. Back then, that third paragraph, when they bring up all of these ritualistic schemes of purification, we forgot to mention back there in that third paragraph, and they said, sin was ritual, not rational, an act, not a thought. You know, it was ritual. You know, there's a rite, right? It's an act. Notice how it started that way, But it didn't stay that way. Eventually, you confess, the confession thing. You confess that you've sinned in thought, word, and deed. Not just, so now you expand the definition of sin from just being a deed thing to also being a word thing and a thought thing. And so it basically spans all three infinite persons instead of just the God of action. You take it all the way back to the universal Father, all right? The thought God. It just another way that it doesn't stay simple. It gets more and more complex and more totalitarian, more and more oppressive. Until you find yourself just, you're hopelessly stuck, and the only thing you can hope for is some magic man to come along and liberate you from all of this bondage. Enter Jesus, right? Or so it seems. That was his purpose, right? To liberate you from all of this. And so he becomes, rationalized as the liberator from all of this oppression of sin, sacrifice, and atonement. Okay.
Chris?
Yep.
So I was thinking temporal does have meaning and significance. And so...
Just not all significance.
Right.
Yeah.
So hygiene came out of
this. Yeah, right. You noticed at the end.
And that's not a spiritual thing, but it's still part of the spiritual scheme in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they've pointed out over and over again, the one of the most hilarious things about all these foolish, illusory notions about ghost land and spirit land is people back into material pragmatism with it. Facing them, you cannot get them to wash to save yourself, but you can get them to back into washing, right? If you, create some woo-woo religious notion attached to it. All of that progresses in spite of ourselves. Right? It's not a coincidence that that you back into material pragmatism. It's a conspiracy, right? It's set up that way. But eventually, you can't just back into the age of light and life. And eventually you have to turn around and face forward. And we're at that time. That's why the book is here. We're trying to still back into light and life. We've already gone as far as you can go forward backing, with our back facing to the future in reverse, right? And for the last over 100 years, all of this in reverse has been literally taking us backwards. And not forward anymore. All right. So now, like I said, we're gonna bring in a little bit more of this complexity here. When you go beyond just the simple taboo violation, death, and you put in all the shades of gray and the complexities.
Section 3, renunciation and humiliation. Renunciation came as the next step in religious evolution. Fasting was a common practice. Soon it became the custom to forego many forms of physical pleasure, especially of a sexual nature. The ritual of the fast was deeply rooted in many ancient religions and has been handed down to practically all modern theologic systems of thought.
Not only was, but is. Still deeply rooted. Very difficult for anyone that feels a religious urge to not at least consider the purifying potentials for themselves of fasting, especially if they're fraught with guilt about a former anything goes life. Right, they want to go forward into a relationship with God. It's like, well, yeah, but how could I possibly have a relationship with God when I'm of all of those taboo violations of the past? I'm unclean. How do I purify myself? You know, well, if I'll probably be purified if I get all of the food and waste out of my alimentary canal. Right? Again, thinking so simply materially, right? In, you know, and rationalizing it, you know, as a spiritual parallel. Okay. So, just, you know, the same thing that Jesus was struggling with so much, you know, interpreting everything he said materially. All right, let's see, what else do we have here? I already mentioned, you know, if you're going to start holding back and forego things, you know, everyone is immediately going to have a lot of focus on that powerful spiritual mojo domain, you know, of sex, like we've seen over and over and over again. And notice again, we have a re prefix. You know, we have renunciation. You know, so you have, you know, and here, remember how I've pointed out you can do, you know, both directions with religion. You have religion on the one hand and alligion on the other hand, right? I mean, one back and one to. Well, you know, we have announce, right? That's to tell to, right? And then you have renounce, to tell back. See, so again, thinking that religion is all about changing the direction of the arrow. It's like, well, yeah, okay, but point the arrow back to eternity, not just back, you know, in time. You know, and kind of doing a magical time travel thing where you go back in time and it's as if you never sinned. Right? That's the current scheme. It's all temporal.
Rewind.
Yeah, just rewind it, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's, you know, that's what they're, you know, they didn't have the way to think about it in more literal terms like we can in the 20th and 21st century when you dream up, you know, relativity and have the notion of time like a ruler, and so you can literally picture yourself going back in time along this supposed ruler. But effectively, that's what they're doing. See, in a non-technological sense, if you will, or quote-unquote scientific sense, they're thinking of it in the magical sense of just, you know, it's as if that never happened. If you do these proper rituals, you know, that part of it literally goes back to before what had happened, and you're clean again.
Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it?
All right. See, so it's the same thing.
I wouldn't do it over again. I wouldn't do it the way I did it. Right.
See, we all know it's that same desire that drives the use of backward time travel in all the science fiction stories, right? Right? They want to go back and, you know, correct, you know, the boo-boo.
But remember, they say if you do something, it's going to screw everything on board.
Right.
Prime direct.
See, so, I mean, see, If you just notice it's the exact same wishful thinking, one where you have fooled yourself that it's real because it's got equations involved with it, and the other one is not real because it's obviously magical thinking. No, they're both magical thinking, right? You know, in the same way that there isn't any literalness to renunciation, you know, and whatnot, you know, there isn't backward time travel or forward time, but there isn't time travel at all. Right? Because it's absurd. It's obviously absurd. All right.
Those some beings can travel awful fast.
Right, but it doesn't mean that they're traveling along some time ruler. Time is not a reality, no matter how fast they're going. So just, you know, back to this. And notice how they actually say what I've said a number of times. All modern theologic systems of thought. Right? It's important to kind of just say it in that full sense, because you got to recognize there's been thousands of years of dotting I's and crossing T's. This is an elaborate, self-consistent system. It has every I dotted and every T crossed. It's a complete lifestyle solution. It's at all internally makes, you know, if you adopt the initial assumptions, it all follows, okay? And it has a wholeness to it. It has a logic to it. It's a false logic, but it has a logic to it. So it's a system of thought. And it's very difficult for us to believe that something that has that measure of completeness and precision, detail to it, how that could be just totally void of any reality. But that's what you have to finally recognize, that there's nothing there. It's all based upon illusion. All the initial assumptions are false.
Eventually, they'll be better.
It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a theologic system. Just because the current ones are false doesn't mean there can't be one that's true. In the same way that just because all the metaphysics is false that humans have generated doesn't mean there can't be true metaphysics. That's what's in your lap. Right? This is a true metaphysics. It's the upper hemisphere.
Yeah. The idea that God doesn't take offense, it requires a level of maturity to appreciate that. If you don't have that maturity, that's a dangerous thought to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Again, it's not a thought that should be given to someone ahead of time. I mean, if you were a planetary prince and gave him that thought ahead of time, that would be called rebellion. See, it's not done. That's why, you know, it's a very difficult thing what you have in your lap here, right? It would be better if a millstone were hanged about your neck and you were cast into the sea, right? Like I've been saying, to say even the simple sentence, you know, that all of these ceremonies are meaningless. That shouldn't be said to almost anyone on the planet. You can't rip that away from them. It'll just be total chaos. It's the only reason there's any stability to our planet, because we have these solemn schemes that we've developed. All right. No, let's keep going.
Just about the time barbarian man was recovering from the wasteful practice of burning and burying property with the dead, just as the economic structure of the races was beginning to take shape, this new religious doctrine of renunciation appeared, and tens of thousands of earnest souls began to court poverty. Property was regarded as a spiritual handicap. These notions of the spiritual dangers of material possession were widespreadly entertained in the times of Philo and Paul, and they have markedly influenced European philosophy ever since.
And do we not know that? Okay. Because, of course, you know, if we throw out all of the old superstitious religion, as we say, you know, are we going to throw this out? No, we're not going to throw this out. We're going to rework this. This is going to become the nucleus of all the new evolutionary religions. How many secular people know that capital is evil? For instance, right?
We should give all our capital to the church.
To the poor.
And... Before we play this out too much, you know, I wanted to give you an example, you know, of exactly what they're hinting at, right at the end there. Obviously, Philo and Paul, they're telling you that this became, you know, one of the core essences of Christianity, right? It's hard to even think about Christianity without this. And so, you know, here is a perfect example of exactly what they're talking about in this paragraph. This is Pope Francis, Okay? He says, we all have to think if we can become a little poorer. All of us have to do this. How can I become a little poorer in order to be more like Jesus, who was the poor teacher?
He who was in the Vatican.
Right. You know, I mean, of all the recent popes, I mean, he most definitively identifies with this core theologic notion that they're pointing out in this paragraph. This whole issue that poverty was, you know, is regarded as a spiritual handicap. Exactly, you know, see, it's obviously exactly what he's saying. And he's pointing to Jesus as pointing out that the reason that Jesus was so spiritual is because he wasn't handicapped by wealth, by capital. He certainly didn't, remember, capital means of the head. He certainly didn't have anything in his head. He was pure feeling. Eh? That's what that's saying, right, between the lines. Again, you go, wait a minute, you remember, didn't I just tell you, we were talking about the knowledge of, tree of knowledge of good and evil, how it's best not to know very much, see, right, it's best not to have anything of the head.
Right, but the Pope's appealing to his base.
Of course, I know, but again, but that's my, you know, if it's setting all the politics and stuff aside, he isn't just pulling this out of thin air. This isn't just because he's comes from South America and he's got revolutionary theology, but you know, liberation theology bias and all that. No. I mean, the core thing is it's not some current phenomenon. Sure, you can rationalize it in a current context with liberation theology and stuff like that. But see, they're pointing out, no, it's foundational in Philo and Paul, and hence in Christianity. I mean, he's trying, you know, in a sense, he's trying to be more pure. He's trying to get people back to the pure principles that they believe the religion is founded on, that the founding fathers said. Was there?
Been saying it's more blessed to give than receive.
Yeah. Right. See, it's that. Like I said, it's this whole renunciation fetish. Right. See, I mean, you know, in your lack of capital, right, you clear the capital out, and it allows the spirit to enter in. It's a fetish, right? That voiding, you know, it's not just, see, they're not just trying to create a void permanently. They're just trying to initially clear that which is evil out of the way so that the spirit can possess you. See, and remember, you know, notice they say, you know, material possession. See, again, it reminds you of, you know, see, again, it just feeds into that old notion that the material objects are possessed, right? And those are false gods that are inside of those material objects, right? You know, and if you identify with those false gods in those material objects, those false gods possess you. They fill your empty space. You know, you need to clear your empty space of that false god and let the real god enter in. That's the scheme. It's fetishism still.
But Chris, before Jesus came, as whoever talks about in the Jewish religion, the blessing of wealth was the opposite. It was, you know.
Yes, right.
God See, looked upon you if you had that. You
know? Yeah, right. And we just read about that. You know, the whole fact that, you know, prosperity and righteousness, you know, were so tightly tied, as we were just, you know, towards the end of the preceding section, we were just talking about that. Yeah, see, that was one scheme, but it wasn't the only scheme.
It totally flipped.
Right, other people had the completely, you know, 180 degrees flipped scheme, right, and they're trying to, you know, they're explaining how that got started, you know, and most significantly to Western civilization, who were devotees of that scheme, of that cult, you know, those beliefs. Philo and Paul were really big on that, you know, and remember how much, you know, the Rancho book tells you Luke was focused on social justice issues too. And I said, you know, between all of these, it all conspires together to just, you know, kind of obliterate what Jesus actually taught.
Well,
you know, and Jews, get this very humanistic scheme in its place.
The Jews, to a large extent, hold on to the notion that wealth was a sign of God's favor.
Yeah.
So that put them at loggerheads with the Christians in the Middle Ages and beyond, even up to the current day.
Yeah, see, and like I was saying, I mean, just think about, you know, you come to recognize that, you know, you have to use your head to get wealth, you know, and of all the parts of my body, which part do I feel I really want to be most possessed by God? Not my toenails, my head. See, and so, right, see, capital of the head, right, was, you know, began to be held up, right? You began to reverse that tendency of oh boy, you don't want to know anything, to actually, no, you remember you pointed out how we have the word ingenuity, right? Right, that God's genius is in you. And it's, in the world can see that God is in you by your material prosperity. You have the material genius, the material pragmatism to succeed. Right? That's a sure sign that you're possessed by God. Right? Sure, it's still fetishistic, but at least see, right? It's making some progress. Okay. So yeah, it's very unfortunate that instead of kind of evolving that forward, you get these negating modes. You kind of go back to, you know, using your spiritual inclinations in a negative rather than a positive mode. All right. Yeah. So anyway, back to this paragraph. Right. You know, you finally got him to stop burning and burying everything with the dead, and then, you know, then possessing something becomes evil, quote unquote. And you know, the planetary administrators are rolling their eyes. You know, let's see. Tens of thousands of earnest souls began to court poverty. You know, you can just hear it between the lines. It's like, oh, delightful. And get all of this earnestness directed to that end. If only they could be earnest for seeking first the kingdom of heaven instead of poverty. Okay.
But isn't the kingdom of heaven poverty? I mean, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You know, we sit here because we read the Ranch book, you know, and we understand a lot more, but most people don't. They don't see it from the same perspective.
Yeah, right. Well, like I said, I mean, that's basically what the Pope is telling you. The kingdom of heaven is poverty. It's to be found in poverty. Right? Yeah. I mean, he's earnest, but he has a false initial assumption frame, right? I mean, he's got this frame. Okay, let's keep going here.
Poverty was just a part of the ritual of the mortification of the flesh, which, unfortunately, became incorporated into the writings and teachings of many religions, notably Christianity. Penance is the negative form of this oft-times foolish ritual of renunciation. But all this taught the savage self-control, and that was a worthwhile advancement in social evolution. Self-denial and self-control were two of the greatest social gains from early evolutionary religion. Self-control gave man a new philosophy of life, taught him the art of augmenting life's fraction by lowering the denominator of personal demands, instead of always attempting to increase the numerator of selfish gratifications.
Because that's a pretty fun thing to visualize it. See, mathematically, you know, you want the ratio to get larger, right? You know, because the ratio is life, see, life's fraction. You want it to be greater, augmented. Well, you know, you can do that two ways. You can increase the numerator or you can decrease the denominator. Yeah? And, you know, I mean, what's the first thing that you're attracted to? You know, the numerator or the denominator? I mean, forget about, you know, what's in the numerator and denominator, but just think conceptually, right? You go to the numerator first, right? So you go to, you know, increasing the self-gratification first, right? It's a subtler thing, but see, they're pointing out you're actually getting people to think a little bit more subtly, to not go for the immediate low-hanging fruit of your most basic urges. You know, we need self-discipline, and you can probably tell when they italicize self-control. Obviously, the theme here going forward is it starts out in the negative mode, and you want to shift it to the positive mode, right? It starts out as self-denial. That's your initial thought. When you read about self-mastery in the Jesus Papers, you're not going to initially think genuine self-control. You're going to think self-denial, because you're going to think about not transgressing any taboos, right? Right, right. You're not going to genuinely think self-control, right? You know, as a positive and positive contrast to self-denial. I mean, obviously, there's some controlling, you know, in self-denial. But see, to make it fully a positive concept and not a negative one. You know, just like they were saying, penance is a negative form. That whole bit of, God is offended. You know, what do I have to do so that he's satisfied? You know, tell me what I need to do. Okay, and then I do that, so then my sins are absolved, right? Yep. Then it's as if it never happened. It totally goes back to before that, right? And all you had to do was just confess your sins, seek forgiveness, right? And accept, what God is, expects here. And then, you know, the magic woo-woo guy, the priest, will absolve your sins.
Rinse and repeat.
Yep, rinse and repeat. It's as if you never jumped in that mud puddle after mom washes your clothes, right? Because she's got that magic, laundry detergent that they're advertising, right?
I mean, I wasn't supposed to eat that.
Before I do that first thing, is there anything else there? Self-control gave man a new philosophy of life. See, the very fact that they're saying that way is reminding you it's getting more sophisticated, where it's sort of not just the unwitting folk ways and stuff, but there's more and more consciousness going on, right? And you can speak of it as a philosophy of living, you know, more what's going on here. All you need to do is put a true framework around that philosophic tendency, and you've got something. Okay. The way it begins there, this is, you know, very important, again, to focus in on this, that expression mortification, you know, using that technical term of mortification of the flesh. Okay, so think about this more precisely. Remember, mortify means to make dead. You know, the mort part is dead, and the fi part is to make, right? To make dead. So this is the basic thought that underlies this. To be prideful is to be alive. Right? To be humiliated is to be made dead. Mortified. I'm mortified. Right? See, I'm made dead. I'm humiliated. Right? And I say, if to be humiliated, if that's to be made dead, right, just simple humility is just dead. So your basic natural scheme that you identify with is so biased away from humble. Humble is dead. This is the way it feels to your incessant clamoring self, right? Looking for recognition and honor, right? That very fact, that mortification of flesh, that's bringing it to the point, right? That literally the assumption is to be prideful is to be alive, right? And to be humble is to be dead. Very biased initial assumption set, see? And so when you see things like pride goeth before a fall, oh, that's got to be some sort of revelatory influence. That didn't come about naturally. The natural scheme is, pride is good. And we've talked about that. We like to say, man, I am so proud of my son. See, we want that to be a positive word, my pride in my son makes me feel alive. To be prideful is to be alive. To be humble is to be dead. This is how it feels to your animal origin nature. See, and it couldn't be farther from the truth. But it's very difficult for humans to adopt the opposite. That pride goeth before a fall. And we're talking real death. Pride takes you to iniquity. Real death. And so that whole mortification of flesh, you don't have to have, like a Western Christian, like theological scheme. I mean, how many people in the world have the notion that to become holy is to die to self. Right? You use that term, die to self. See, that's the mortification of the flesh. That's predicated on the assumption that that pride is good and humility is bad. Our God is a living God. You should be proud. It's a very insidious scheme that we've developed.
Aren't there some quote unquote religions out there that are really pushing being more and more humble? You're like nothing, you're like less than the water, you're less than.
Yes, they are. See, this is the crazy inconsistent, schizophrenic thing that's going on in their theologic system of thought. They give lots of lip service to humility, but they also talk about dying to self. It's like, okay, think about that for a second. If I reject myself, what's going to be humble? I mean, it's the self that's humble. If the self is bad and rejected, where exactly is this humility? Oh, it's in some delusional, transcendent me above that self. It's in a prideful sphere above the self. It's an insidious thing that they don't recognize, that they actually believe the very thing that they give lip service to in the opposite. It's prideful to think that you can somehow exist transcendent of yourself. I mean, what do you think you are? That's what you are as a self. Right? And the point is to take control of that self so that it's humble. And not prideful. And especially not this insidious, under-the-radar pride. That's a delusional thing where you've falsely exalted some transcendent you, that's above that self.
It's like Jesus, why do you call me good?
Yeah. Only God is good, right? Yeah.
Real humble. humble.
Right. It's a very he's not rejecting himself. His self is saying that. His self is taking on humility. He's not dying to self. He's taking control of himself. Right? It's a very insidious, twisted scheme that got developed here. Okay, and it infects Eastern and Western thought. Okay, let's keep going here.
These olden ideas of self-discipline embraced flogging and all sorts of physical torture. The priests of the mother cult were especially active in teaching the virtue of physical suffering, setting the example by submitting themselves to castration. The Hebrews, Hindus, and Buddhists were earnest devotees of this doctrine of physical humiliation.
Because obviously, in the most primitive forms, all these concepts are thought of materially, exercised materially. And they move up from matter to mind, as the concepts mature. They're just reminding you, it starts out very, very literal. Right? There's no sense of being mentally humiliated. I mean, humiliated is thought of in physical terms. I put a big hack in my arm or something. I chop off a finger or whatever. Notice again between the lines, they're reminding you of the foundations of Christianity. Right? It wasn't just Philo and Paul and whatnot. Another very key thing that fed into that is the mother cult. Right? And so accentuated the concept of suffering, rationalization schemes about suffering. I mean, even that word penance that we just passed through, that goes back to the word passion, which is the word suffering. Right? See, the whole point is, you've sinned and God expects you to suffer a little bit. Right, do penance, right, and then everything's okay. Right, you're purified through suffering. Right, so they're just pointing out the mother cult influence into Christianity with, the Mother Mary, obviously. Augmented that fixation on suffering in Christianity. Not to mention, of course, Jesus suffering and dying on the cross. But it wasn't just Jesus, the rationalization of the cross. The mother cult fed into it, too. That's what they're pointing out there.
Yep. How does that contrast with the idea that pain and suffering are essential for progressive evolution?
Yeah, they're essential to progressive evolution. They're just there. You don't have to seek them. They are of the domain in which you exist. You don't want to attempt to existentialize the fact of the temporal domain, right, and exalt it into this, give it this spiritual eternal significance. A similar thing is, the potential of evil is plenty to drive things. You don't have to have the actuality of sin and iniquity. Right? That's a similar, contrast there. All right, let's keep going.
All through the olden times, men sought in these ways for extra credits on the self-denial ledgers of their gods. It was always customary when under some emotional stress to make vows of self-denial and self-torture. In time, these vows assumed the form of contracts with the gods, and in that sense represented true evolutionary progress in that the gods were supposed to do something definite in return for this self-torture and mortification of the flesh. Vows were both negative and positive. Pledges of this harmful and extreme nature are best observed today among certain groups in India.
They take that mortification of the flesh thing very, very literally there, you know, and they'll drive a stake through their cheeks, and go through a whole long ritual or something with this rod through their cheeks or whatever, right? Or even, the greater tendency for people to literally reenact Jesus' crucifixion if they're a Christian, in some of those Eastern lands. It's not enough to just think it through in deep feelingfulness in your mind. You got to literalize it, right? And literally nail yourself to a cross. Those obviously the more primitive peoples are still going to think in more literal material terms, even today. In this whole bit of getting extra credits, the gods are sitting there with their ledgers, and you can get gold stars, if you do some extreme self-denial thing.
It feels natural.
And see, again, it feels so natural, not only because, like you're pointing out, this all develops naturally, but, we're just nurtured in this whole scheme. It's like, how else would you think about God? Right? It's kind of the question that's sort of between the lines here. And that's the challenge. Can you try to think about a relationship to God apart from this whole notion? Notice they slipped that in there. And in that sense represented true evolutionary progress, and then the gods were supposed to do something definite in return for this self-torture and mortification of the flesh. Okay, the schemes are primitive and crude and absurd, but at least it's a step forward from thinking that God is just this totally standoffish fact, that's just standing above, taking great delight in your suffering and all this, and just sitting there laughing at you. The gods are all sitting around, drinking wine and stuff and grapes in their mouths and, watching this the human suffering and dying. Isn't it great fun, right? Spectator sport. No, God actually, there is an interplay between you and God. Okay, it's a foolish interplay, but at least you're bringing in the concept that there's some interplay. And if God in some sense is touching you, could you turn around and touch God?
What I meant by that is that sometimes it almost comes on, even though you have to be stay conscious to not have that just happen.
Yes, you do.
So like.
Yeah, and that's why all this is in the book, to try to get this all up front, to methodically step through this, I've never really thought about all these details. Get all those details out in front of you so that you can be conscious of them, Catch yourself slipping into that mode. Don't beat yourself. Don't be humiliated because you slipped in the right, Don't feel guilty, right? But just notice that that's your natural tendency. And to be religious is to be unnatural. To be really religious is to not do that. Think and rationalize your relationship to God in that natural way. That's not what prayer is about, for instance. It's not about all this sort of stuff. And trying to, get your a more favorable temporal relationship with God. It's about something greater than that. All right. See anything else there? Maybe just point out, they don't say self-denial and self-torture. Self-torture seems to be even worse, but at least it's a positive thing, right? Now if you could just not think so in such primitive terms about a positive mode. Instead of that self-negating mode, right, get yourself to do something instead of not do something. Get to the thou shalt rather than the thou shalt not mode. Right? You know, it's going to start out, thou shalt torture, move it forward. Move it from matter through mind to spirit. Thou shalt use spirit to reframe your mind and have that mind be born again. That's what thou shalt do. That's self-control.
Right? It was only natural that the cult of renunciation and humiliation should have paid attention to sexual gratification. The continence cult originated as a ritual among soldiers prior to engaging in battle. In later days, it became the practice of saints. This cult tolerated marriage only as an evil lesser than fornication. Many of the world's great religions have been adversely influenced by this ancient cult, but none more markedly than Christianity. The Apostle Paul was a devotee of this cult, and his personal views are reflected in the teachings which he fastened onto Christian theology. Quote, "It is good for a man not to touch a woman," unquote. "I would that all men are even as myself, as I myself. And I say, therefore, to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them to abide, even as I." Paul well knew that such teachings were not a part of Jesus' gospel, and his acknowledgement of this is illustrated by his statement, "I speak this by permission and not by commandment." But this cult led Paul to look down upon women. And the pity of it all is that his personal opinions have long influenced the teachings of a great world religion. If the advice of the tent maker teacher were to be literally and universally obeyed, then would the human race come to a sudden and inglorious end? Furthermore, the involvement of a religion with the ancient continence cult leads directly to a war against marriage and the home, society's veritable foundation, and the basic institution of human progress. And it is not to be wondered at that all such beliefs fostered the formation of celibate priesthoods in the many religions of various peoples.
Great big long paragraph. Finally, we're going to really get to that. Of all self-denials, what's the most important? Right? It's all that sex stuff. Right? It's always the foundational, most powerful mojo sex stuff. Just think about the literalness of continence. It's the root there is like contain. Contain yourself, or more literally, hold yourself together. Right. It has a self-control concept right in its name, right? Hold yourself together. Don't let it all hang out, right? As we say. It's just predicated on that which is kind of the most furthest removed from the spiritual level. It's all about playing around on the level of the flesh rather than, all the way up at the other end of the hourglass. On the spiritual level, like I was saying, self-control is to, use spirit to reframe your mind and take control of your mind, as opposed to using the bottom levels of your mind to control your body. I'm saying, no, it's about spirit controlling mind, not about mind controlling body. That's the kind of self-control we're talking about. The self is a mindful self, not a material self. But humans have never been able to figure that out, really, right? Self-control is always about what my molecules of my body are doing. That's not what self-control is really about. It's your mind that is to be controlled, not your body. If you control your mind, your body will follow suit because mind dominates matter. Right? But you won't have to worry about your body. Problem is your mind is not controlled. And to believe that you don't need to control your mind is to begin to assume that your mind is innately divine, which is the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. Okay. A lot of people who are familiar with Christianity, know that's all coming from 1 Corinthians there with Paul. And all of, that's just kind of part of his whole problematic assumption set about men and women and sex and whatnot. It isn't just Paul, but the fact that Paul kind of got it started, like they're saying, that means that, you can have St. Augustine, kind of fully flesh it out on steroids and just fixate, sin on sex issues forevermore. Go back to our the beginning here. This transgression of taboo. That we're trying to move towards a definition of sin that has nothing to do with taboos. Which means it has nothing whatsoever to do with sex. And that's just very difficult. Again, like I said, you just can't help but think in those terms. If someone talks about immorality, what's the first thing that pops into your head? Some sex scandal that's recently occurred or something, right? Or maybe even something that you've done that you feel guilty about, right? It doesn't mean that one shouldn't concern yourself with how you behave sexually, right? But see, it's an issue of the state, not of the church, if you will, right? It's an issue of society regulating itself with law and you violating those laws. It has nothing to do with sin. It has nothing to do with religion. But it's very difficult because, like I said, they started together and they're still together. To completely let go of that, let go of it religiously. Let it be, a law issue where it appropriately is, right? Religion is predicated on that other end where there's love. Right? Not the law and justice end, but there needs to be a law and justice end, but religion, is at the love end of the spectrum. Okay, and that's very difficult. Your moral level is predicated on that spiritual level, the level of love and God-knowingness. Moral is not tied to the law level. And it's just very difficult to rethink that. Let's see, anything else there? You got to love the quote-unquote. In later days, it became the practice of saints. they're purposely contrasting the soldiers and the saints there, just remind you of how silly this is, It's like, I'm going to fight, better, in Greece, because I'm not going to have sex before we go into battle. And all that just gets reworked into this, now you're a really fancy spiritual person, you're a saint.
Well, it is true, though. When you play a high sport, you lost your energy.
Right. See, and again, the very fact that you think of you know, your energy is your spiritual possession, and the energy goes away, so your spiritual possession, you know, goes away. See, it's because all of this stuff is rational. Right, right, right. See, yeah, see, that's the thing. We've all rationalized this materially.
Everyone knows that that you won't give your best if you've already rewarded yourself ahead of time.
right, there's all these things. See, and of course, there's validity in all these sorts of things of kind of fooling ourselves and whatnot and manipulating ourselves. Okay, but that doesn't have anything to do, see, with God. But we've taken all of that physics of material pragmatism and rationalized it over into the spiritual domain. And so we've got renunciation and humiliation and blah, blah, blah. We've got all these notions, see? All right, let's wrap it up here.
Someday, man should learn how to enjoy liberty without license, nourishment without gluttony, and pleasure without debauchery. Self-control is a better human policy of behavior regulation than is extreme self-denial. Nor did Jesus ever teach these unreasonable views to his followers.
Okay, so three elements there. Okay, the first thing, someday man should. Okay, all the things they list there, that's what it means to be in the material comfort era, correct? Yeah. Right? That's where you have liberty with license, nourishment with gluttony, pleasure with debauchery. That is the material comfort era. And, you know, and it's appropriate in its time, you know, as a stepping stone to greater things, sort of as a culmination of the nutrition epic in the security age. Okay, but, you know, not only someday man should, but, you know, you must, if you are going to take that step to the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right, you've got to begin to take control of yourself. And like I told you, they would say, it's the self-control, the positive thought that you want to think about, not the self-denial.
What do they mean by with license? Liberty, how we understand it? It's always kind of confused me. Maybe I'm just dumb.
Thy liberty and law. Right? I mean, I got to go get a license before I can do this, because that's the law. Right? I mean, you know, your liberty needs to be in law. Right? It can't just be anything goes.
So with license, then.
Right? Yeah. See.
Oh, but then.
Yeah, but you know, you've got that, and you know, see, but it's, you know.
When you get it without a license, it becomes higher, real liberty, I guess.
Right. I mean, you know, just see. I mean, the way we use that term is. Well, that's not liberty, that's license. You know, in other words, you know, you are the law. You're defining this. It's self-righteousness.
You're not the boss of me?
Yeah, well, just, you know, I define what's right. You know, I have the right to, in the name of liberty, to do whatever I want to anyone I want, to, you know, however I want, right? Yep, you bet.
Okay. Taking liberties.
Yes. We play on these words, you gotta think about that. So like I said, it's the self-control, right? Not the self-denial, you know, or at least bound yourself away from thinking that self-mastery is extreme self-denial. Right? At least start there, like they're saying. Okay. And then I want to come back to that fat last sentence again. Nor did Jesus ever teach these unreasonable views to his followers. Okay? He didn't teach self-denial. Okay? And yet, the vicar of Christ, the voice of Jesus on earth today, teaches self-denial. Poverty. Right? See, so they come back to it at the very end. They want to remind you of that's false. You know, again, think about moving inward in the psychic circles, moving up the cosmic levels of those psychic circles, right, there will be material success on higher cosmic levels. You can't go up except with a super additive consequence. And it is a relationship between material pragmatism and spiritual idealism. Right? Now, just because you have material success doesn't imply you're at a higher cosmic level. But if you're at a higher cosmic level, right, you know how to face facts. Right? You know how to engage the material world and its practical demands. Right? You have cosmic consciousness. Okay, so I just wanted to point out that they come back around and don't just say, it's not just the Pope is playing off of Philo and Paul. Right? They want to remind you how the Pope is apart from Jesus, despite the fact that he's called the Vicar of Jesus Christ. When he goes into that self-denial mode of thought, of modern theologic systems of thought.
John, when the law is written in your heart, for example, that's an individual that enjoys liberty without license, because the law is in him. Right? So maybe that helps. Give me liberty or give me death.
Right. But it's just, I think we got that. I mean, appreciate how. Like you have expression like, you've given yourself license to do that. Yeah. So it's, there's a subtle way that we're using that word, kind of playing it a little bit in both directions, because, it's like I said, it's like righteousness and self-righteousness. okay. All right. So next time we transition, maybe take the next step. Like I said, we're building to atonement, so we need to develop the concept of sacrifice, and how that that obviously is building on where we were here with ideas of renunciation and such. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.